Hello and welcome to South Dakota Public Broadcasting's United States House of Representatives Forum. I'm Stephanie Rissler. Tonight we're going to introduce you to the two candidates hoping to win your vote to become South Dakota's only U.S. representative. We were unable to have both candidates join me for a live conversation. Instead, each visited with me for one-on-one interviews to talk about why they are running and the issues important to South Dakotans. We will begin with the Republican candidate, incumbent U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson, who visited with me in the Leo P. Flynn Gallery inside our Sioux Falls studio. Representative Johnson, thanks for being with us today. Voters, they're going to head to the voting booth in November. They've got a lot on their mind, including who they want to send back to Washington. I think most South Dakotans will know you and they recognize you. But as you visit with us tonight, explain to them why you're running again and why they should consider you.
Well, I just don't think politics is a spectator sport. And I know so many Americans are cynical and they kind of want to pull away from it. But that's just not how I'm wired. And I'll be honest, this country isn't running perfectly like I want. But I have seen in my 2 years in Washington that hard work, optimism, a desire to build common ground, these are still characteristics that matter. And they do make a difference. I mean, they do manifest themselves in positive outcomes. I mean, I passed 4 bills off the floor of the U.S. House in the last 2 years. And honestly, I didn't know a freshman in the minority could do that. But I feel like this work matters.
I'm not going to ask a lot of questions that will differentiate between you and your opponent. The only one I'm going to ask is, if you have to look at the two individuals that folks will vote for, what are the differences? What would you say?
Well, I'll start with the commonalities. I mean, I would tell you, Uriah loves his country, and he's a good person with a good heart. And I love my country, and I think I'm a good person with a good heart. And so I'm certainly not going to say anything particularly negative about Uriah. I mean, I think it's good that he's running. I think voters win when they have a choice. And that's what our whole system's about, right? It's about options. Not everybody shares my worldview, and I'm not going to get every single vote. I mean, I do think one area where I'm stronger is in my ability to get things done. I know a certain number of politicians love to go to D.C., and they think their job is messaging. They think their job is to offer hot takes on Twitter. And I'm just not a keyboard warrior. I mean, when I put information out there, I think generally it is to inform voters and try to advance our agenda of actually getting things done. And I didn't realize, frankly, before I got to D.C., that every week, now this would be pre-COVID, but every week there are bills that pass off the floor of the U.S. House with a couple hundred Democrat votes and a couple hundred Republican votes. D.C. doesn't work like it should, but it isn't as broken as we fear. And in that environment, we do need people who I think are well-positioned to be able to govern.
I'm going to talk about some of the things that you have worked on in Washington in terms of agriculture, the Price Act. Explain to our viewers what that is, what it will do, and from there.
Well, I'll start with the problem. We are in a soft price environment for cattle producers, and both the Holcomb fire last year and COVID-19 this year has, I think, highlighted, even for my urban colleagues, some of the weaknesses in the supply chain. And when things get tough, when we have these negative occurrences, producers get a lot less for their product on the hoof, and consumers pay a lot more at the meat case. And that's not what we want. That's not a well-functioning market. And so so many of my colleagues, they love to swing for the fences. And you get more attention when you swing for the fences, when you put out this incredibly bold plan that's going to transform something. It's really hard to get those things passed. And frankly, all too often, those, you know, earth-shattering ideas don't actually accomplish the policy goals we want them to. And so the Price Act takes a different approach. Instead of hitting a home run or trying to and striking out, it pulls together 12 different singles and doubles, important things to improve transparency in the cattle market, to make it easier for small processors to go out and sell across lines to direct to consumer, trying to make sure that we're making better use of our CRP and some of our grazing lands. And those things together, I'll put it this way. If you can put together an inning with 12 singles and doubles, you are in a great position to win the game. And our plan has already been endorsed by a strong bipartisan group, lots of national ag groups. And we're going to build momentum because this is too important not to get done.
I want to go back to agriculture. It is our state's number one industry, and whether or not you sit on the Ag Committee, you have found a way to make sure those in South Dakota are being represented. How have you been able to do that?
Well, I think it comes down to hard work. I mean, Washington, D.C. is different than Sioux Falls or Falkton or Mitchell or Spearfish or Custer, but it has some similarities too. And one of the similarities is if you work hard and you know your stuff, your colleagues in that community look to you for guidance. And that's really been my goal. Listen, I don't want the fanciest office in Washington, D.C. I don't want to be the Speaker of the House. I don't need to have the most Twitter followers. I mean, my goal is really to be a voice for rural America. Out of 435 members, there are only 45 who represent districts that are mostly rural by population. And so those of us who understand what life is like out here, I think are duty bound not just to represent the Constitution, although that's important, and not just to represent South Dakota, although that's important, but also to be somebody who works hard and earns the respect of my colleagues so I can be effective on those issues. And that has been one of the most rewarding parts of my job.
So we have the Price Act. What more needs to be done if you make it back to Washington to help those in the ag industry?
I mean, there's so much insanity around the ethanol arena. I mean, USDA and EPA fight constantly over what should the role of ethanol be in a modern economy. And I've worked with my colleagues on the Democratic side, and we've gotten things done on that front. You know, when we didn't have enough forage, that's feed for cattle. I worked with my colleagues on the other side of the aisle to get the date which you can go out and graze prevent plant acres from November 1st, which was way too late, to September 1st. Those aren't victories that are going to lead the 6 o'clock national news, I get it, but they absolutely do matter for South Dakota. And I want to continue to do more of that. I want, over the course of the next 2 years, I think rural broadband is only going to get more important. Telemedicine, a network infrastructure for things like precision agriculture. We have got to make progress on that. It's too important to leave behind.
You talk about broadband. There are attempts at the state level. Our state leaders are trying to expand broadband, improve that internet connection. We would discover this last spring in rural parts of our state, they have been left behind when it comes to good internet connection. Should COVID continue to take a bad turn, we may see kids learning from home again yet this winter. Are there things that you could do at the federal level to kind of push that up, to increase that internet connection faster?
I mean, we have had the Universal Service Fund, and when it was created, it was all about dial tone. You know, it was getting that plain old telephone service, that POTS, to the farmhouse. But that program has evolved and has provided hundreds of billions of dollars over decades for infrastructure that is now serving high-speed internet. Now, the job is not done in South Dakota. A lot has been done. I talked to a group of industry leaders from this state just 2 days ago, and they tell me it would still take about $200 million to get the rest of South Dakota connected. And I have a lead role. I'm the ranking member, that's the top Republican, on one of the subcommittees that deals with the Farm Bill, which has funding for rural development and for rural broadband. And we're going to continue to work on this. I mean, just 3 weeks ago, in a bipartisan group, 25 Republicans and 25 Democrats came together to endorse a plan that I was one of the chief architects of around COVID-19 relief. And because, Stephanie, COVID-19 has shown us some of these homework gaps you're talking about, our plan had $12 billion to help with rural broadband. And that plan was endorsed by the Washington Post, the New York Times, President Trump, and a broad cross-section of lawmakers.
Okay. The CARES Act provided assistance for many people, businesses that have been struggling. At the same time, our nation is dealing with over $20 trillion in debt. Once we figure out who goes to Washington, how do we have the conversation that looks at our national debt, but at the same time help those people that are in need of help because of COVID?
I mean, before our first case of COVID in this country, we were $23 trillion in debt. And that's the big problem. I mean, frankly, spending during a national emergency isn't the problem. That is one of the areas where I think you can make a pretty strong defense for deficit spending during the bad times. But that means during the good times, you have to right your fiscal ship. And I know a lot of South Dakotans out there just want to believe that if we cut the fat in government, it'll get it taken care of. Well, the reality is you can take, let's say you cut 20% of all of the non-defense, forget the non-defense, all of the discretionary spending, defense and otherwise. So the Department of Ag and Treasury and State and Interior, you cut 20% of all of that budget. you would save about $150 billion. The problem is we're upside down $1,000 billion a year. And so you got to find $850 billion from somewhere else. And that means we've got to have the tough conversations around Medicare, around Medicaid, around Social Security. And I want to make it clear, I'm not looking to take away benefits from anybody who are getting them today. But I'm 44, and I might live 20 years longer than my grandparents, and I'm not offended at the idea that maybe I should work two more years to be able to have that additional 18 years of retirement. And when we start to have real conversations about the math like that, Stephanie, things come into focus far more quickly than most people realize, but you have to have the political courage.
When you travel the state and you share those ideas with South Dakotans, how have they reacted to that?
I think most of them feel a refreshing sense that somebody's actually willing to tell them that this is going to be hard, that it's not just, oh, you know, you cut the bureaucracy out of the Department of Interior and the problem goes away. We do need to cut waste, fraud, and abuse in our federal government. I want to make that very clear. But that's only a part of the problem. And when they see that I'm willing to look them into the eye and talk to them about long-term solutions that don't make me more politically popular, but I think are me trying to own up to my obligation to manage this country in a responsible way, most of them, I think, do give me some credit for that.
I want to talk about wages in our state. We have certain pockets of South Dakota that have great jobs, good paying wages, but we have many pockets of South Dakota that are just, the wages are low. What more can we do to bring some of the more higher paid jobs to South Dakota?
I think a lot of it has to do with the skills gap. I mean, the reality is that, you know, this economy doesn't do a lot to reward unskilled workers, and it does a lot to reward financially skilled workers. And I'm on the Education Committee in Washington, D.C., and we talk all the time about how do you lower the barrier. And it is difficult for a lot of first-time college students to be able to understand how do you even get into a technical college. How do you get into a university? And there are some things we can do to lower the barrier. I mean, one example is some of these federal grants that help low-income students get to school. Their purchasing power has been eroded over years. And we can restore some of the purchasing power. And if we do that, I think we're going to see more first-generation students get into technical college. That's going to give them a much better opportunity to earn a good living. The data tells us that people who have, whether it's a certificate program or a two-year program or a four-year program, somebody who graduates from one of those will make more than $1 million more than somebody who doesn't graduate from one of those programs over the course of their career.
South Dakotans will be voting on two issues regarding marijuana this election, medical marijuana and recreational marijuana, but yet at the federal level, it's illegal. Where do you stand and where do you think that conversation needs to go in Washington?
Well, I don't normally weigh in very heavily on ballot initiatives because I like the voters to be able to make their determination. But, you know, I'm not going to dodge the question. I mean, I just don't think our state would be better off with more drug use. And I understand marijuana is not like heroin, marijuana is not like cocaine. Certainly I've had lots of friends, you know, over the years, mostly in their youth, who use marijuana. And I'm not going to say that it destroyed their lives, but for many of them, I saw that they were less effective, they were less driven, they were less productive during the years they were using marijuana. They weren't better people. And I just, I can't see that a South Dakota with more drug use would be a better South Dakota. And those will be my concerns when I go to vote.
Let's talk about some gun control legislation. And I just went back and looked at some of the information that you share with South Dakotans on your own page. H.R. 8 would criminalize almost all gun transfers between private individuals, including some family members. This was something that you spoke against, you voted against. What conversation should we be having in the United States regarding any type of gun control legislation?
Well, I don't want to say that it's not important for us to talk about, you know, the machinery, about the guns. I continue to feel a pretty deep sadness over the fact that I think we're frankly missing the larger conversation. I mean, we have a profound mental health problem in this country, and we have entirely too many people committing suicide, and entirely too many people whose lives are being destroyed by drug use and by depression and by mental health issues generally. And what we know is that people who go and kill other folks, who murder them with weapons, are overwhelmingly afflicted by these kind of mental health issues. And so, you know, by all means, let's have a conversation conversation about the machinery. But my biggest concern is that anytime Congress goes and votes on something, and in the House we pass something out that does something with background checks or something with bump stocks or something with gun control, it seems like so much of the pressure goes out of the pressure cooker. And now we feel like we've done something. Now Congress feels like it's made society safer. And the reality is, I don't know that there's a lot of evidence for that. I'm a limited government guy, but I will tell you, I think there is a chronic, acute, and unforgivable underinvestment in mental health in this country. And until we're willing to talk about the billions of dollars that that's going to take to make sure that the veteran who's suffering from PTSD in Aberdeen, who is starting to have dark thoughts about hurting himself or others, until we're actually willing to tackle that, I feel like we're not accomplishing what we really want to.
Let's talk about cybersecurity in the United States. Americans are continuously impacted by threats. Maybe they are impacted. They're losing money. What efforts would you like to see at the federal level to better secure Americans from cybersecurity?
Yeah, this is an area that I know a fair amount about because before going to Congress, I was in the broadband world. I was a co-owner of a company in Mitchell that went out and helped build broadband networks across the country and helped those make sure those networks were running properly. And the first thing we need to understand is that China and Russia are not our friends. And they have literally thousands of people employed every single day. And they're investing literally millions of dollars every single day to undermine this country. And their favorite tool of that war is our cyber attacks. And they want to undermine this country's elections. They want to undermine this country's position as the strongest financial nation in the world. They want Americans to fight with one another. And the best defense against that are us individually, right? We need the smart white hat coders and hackers on our side, keeping them out. But we want to make sure that when we get an email that's got a link that we don't recognize or we don't understand, don't click on it. Don't fall for that spear phishing attempt. When we've got somebody who's trying to peddle information on Facebook, telling us about how disgusting a different type of American is, we need to take just 30 seconds to try to verify that information before we forward it. Because when Americans are united, there isn't anything that can beat us. When Americans are fighting with one another, we're just beating ourselves. And frankly, a lot of the government in Russia and China, they love it when that happens.
So it sounds like education is the tool. Do you think that it's a good investment for the government to invest in educating Americans on this?
It is, but I don't want to say that that's the only place that we should invest. Congress has invested hundreds of millions of dollars in election security, which I think is critically important. We've provided those dollars to states, HAVA dollars, Help America Vote Act dollars, and we need to continue to do that. And we also, I think, have a relatively unsophisticated, I shouldn't say that, it's sophisticated, but it's not as good as it should be, investment in our own country's defenses. How we protect our country's data is good, but it's not good enough.
You know, our infrastructure, it's aging in certain parts of our state. In fact, in some parts of the year, farmers, ranchers can't even use their roads. Counties are strapped to fix it. Is there a role that the government should be playing to help our aging infrastructure?
Well, absolutely. I'm a limited government guy, but when you look at the Constitution, which is pretty important to me, you see a clear role for the federal government in infrastructure, in interstate commerce, in what they called in the Constitution post roads, just roads that commerce could travel on, and frankly, that letters could travel on. And I'm absolutely dedicated to continuing the robust federal role in infrastructure investment. And we need to do a better job. In South Dakota and in more than 30 other states in recent years, they've worked to try to restore some of the purchasing power of the gas tax, which had fallen behind in the 20 years since most of the state governments did something. And we need to pass a highway bill next year in Congress. And I'm going to be one of the lead voices in making sure that we do what we can to keep America at the top of the world with regard to infrastructure. That's been my whole background, whether it was dealing with rural energy infrastructure on the Public Utilities Commission or rural broadband infrastructure at my company in Mitchell or working for USDA 20 years ago. In dealing with some of the rural infrastructure we're talking about, I have seen how this is a great investment for our country.
What would you like to accomplish or maybe continue to work on should you make it back?
Well, I think that we do need to get the deficit problem under control, and that's going to take years to do. We didn't get into this problem overnight. We're not going to get out of it overnight. But I think we need people who are willing to say some of the politically dangerous things I said tonight, because I think it's too important for us to just whistle by the graveyard. Secondly, we have weaknesses in our supply chain, and China's not a friend of ours. And I think this pandemic has shown us that they have entirely too much control over our food supply chain and our healthcare supply chain, whether that's vaccinations or testing or medical supplies. I think we need to restore some of the American control over those supply chains. I also want to make sure that for our ag producers and for our South Dakota manufacturers, we add additional market access for them. We know that when we give our producers and manufacturers a fair opportunity to compete across the globe, they are going to win. And we know that, like with the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement that I was on the WIP team for, I helped to secure the votes that was needed there. As we come out of the pandemic, that's going to add 176,000 new American jobs and $2 billion of new ag exports just to two countries, Canada and Mexico. We need to do even more of that, and that will create tremendous economic opportunity for this state and for this country.
What would you like to say to South Dakota voters before they head to the voting booth in November?
Well, I'd like to say thank you. I mean, they entrusted me with 2 years in Washington, D.C. And, you know, I haven't been perfect. Nobody is. But I think I go to work every day wanting to work hard, wanting to find common ground, and wanting to honor South Dakotans with my service. And I'm going to continue to do that. And I'm not somebody who screams about problems as much as I work for solutions. I think that's the South Dakota way. And overwhelmingly, I think South Dakotans have been supportive of that approach. That's how I'm wired, and that's how I'm going to serve them.
All right. Thanks for being with me today.
Thank you.
Randy Llewellyn is the Libertarian candidate running in the U.S. House race. Randy is from Hot Springs, South Dakota. Last week, he was traveling the eastern side of the state visiting with voters. He stopped by the Martin Bush Studio in Vermilion to visit with me. We talked about his own political beliefs and what he hopes to accomplish should he win your vote. Here is part of our conversation. Randy, thanks for being with me today. As you run for the U.S. House seat, a lot of folks will be voting. They may not recognize your name. They may not know anything about you. First, kind of explain to our viewers who you are and why you're running.
All right. My name is Randy Llewellyn. And if you look on the ballot, it'll have Uriah in quotations. That's my nickname. Where I live, that's where everybody knows me as. Mm-hmm. I moved to South Dakota about 5.5 years ago, and I love it here. I moved from Colorado. I participated in a lot of political things there. But as a member of the Libertarian Party, it's very difficult to get elected as a third party. So I've never been elected to office. I did run for House of Representatives in Colorado at one time. I ran against Jared Polis, of all people, who is now the governor.
Yeah.
And so that was an interesting experience. But here I am. I'm 62 years old. I thought I was retired, and yet here I am possibly going into a whole new career. And I don't want to call it a career, because it really shouldn't be a career. I think it was always designed to be for citizen statesmen to sacrifice a few years of their life to serve the rest of the country. I don't think the concept of a political career was really in the minds of the founding fathers, but it's evolved to that.
Sure.
And I think it would be good if we returned to the original concept.
Let's go back to your professional background. How will your professional background help you with this position should South Dakotans send you to Washington?
In a lot of ways. I'm kind of a one-trick pony in that most of my life I've been a Mason. Mm-hmm. And I worked from labor all the way up to having my own business about 35 years, probably pushing 40. And I'm still doing it. I don't do it as hard. I don't do it as long. And I always tell people they don't let a Mason retire. I mean, there's so few of us out there that when people have a job, you could be the only game in town. So I know business. I know how to operate business. I know what business goes through, and I know what they need to do. On the other hand, the other part of my career has been in the military, and it started out in infantry. And I've got 10 good years, 2 active and 10 reserve, or 8 reserve. And my final MOS was I actually taught leadership training, non-commissioned officers education system. So I taught sergeants how to be sergeants. So that was very helpful to me, both in my career as a Mason and in life in general.
We're going to get into the issues. First, thank you for your service to our country. South Dakotans will have 2 individuals to choose from. One, our incumbent Representative Dusty Johnson. They're going to want to know what's different between you and Representative Johnson. Why should they consider you?
What is different? Well, first of all, I'm 62, and I think he's 44. I'm not clear. Very energetic. Mm-hmm. Like him a lot. In fact, we're going to probably share a meal here in a couple of days when I go through Mitchell. But I am a little bit older, I think a little bit wiser. I tend to respond instead of react to things. I'm a good analyst, I'm a good problem solver, and I'm a great listener. I probably spend a lot of my time doing that. As far as Dusty and I, the Libertarian Party and the Republican Party, although I'm not sure if he follows down the line of the Republican Party, I'm pretty much down the line with the Libertarian Party. And we share some things, like limited government and individual rights, hopefully. And but there are other things we probably don't share. I'll tell you where I think there are several things. I'm a constitutionalist. I typically carry it in my pocket. I actually read it. And there's some things that I think that I would bring to Washington that Dusty does not. Bringing local government back and states' rights, and eliminate all the things that are not in the Constitution that the federal government now does that probably shouldn't be doing. Spending. I'm for a balanced budget. You know, think about it. In the last 6 months, the government has spent, what, $6 trillion? And that may not be an exact figure, but what's a billion or two? I mean, this is what we're talking about. We're talking about printed up, borrowed money, such that each child that's born now probably enters life with about a $38,000 debt on their head. Things need to change. Dusty has like a 50% constitutional rating of voting with the Constitution. And that's according to the Freedom Foundation. Mine will be 100%. He recently voted for a spending bill for the military that included a red flag law, which I would never, never have voted for that. And it involved military and retired personnel. It's troubling. So we do differ on some things, and we are the same on some things. But the voice that I will take there will be about change. I mean, for instance, that bill that I was mentioning. Fundamentally, the problem is that we should never have bills that are more than one subject. When you have people that can ingratiate themselves or their constituents by amending a bill that's a good bill, by putting things in there that help you or are very specific or maybe things that nobody else wants, but because they want that bill to pass, they can get those pushed through. That should never happen. Bills should be one subject. And if they're not going to be one subject, you give the president the line item veto, and he can weed it out, and they can take it from there. Neither of those things have happened. I'll take that. There's lots of legislation. If you look on my website,
Well, and actually, I have some questions about some of the things I found on your website.
Okay. you look at my vision list. I've got what I envision happening and how we can transform our government back to one that returns to the people.
So I want to talk about one of the issues on your website. You talk about going to Washington to really get rid of that partisan gridlock, and you want to be part of the solution. This would be our one U.S. House member. How would you be able to make that happen, or at least add to the solution?
Good question. I am deeply disturbed, Stephanie, and I think most Americans are, about the division in this country. Mm-hmm. Now, we've always had division. Probably the most striking, of course, was the Civil War, and erupted in a lot of bloodshed. The division today is pushing that direction, I think. And I think it's rooted in a dysfunctional duopoly in which there's only two parties, and those parties are not concerned with solving our problems and working together. They're working about who's got control and who's got power. And that's pretty much it. And we've seen it in the last 4 years, what's happened in the Trump administration. The impeachment, all of those things. How much didn't get done during that period? A lot. Mm-hmm. Some things did get done. So sending a third party would be a game changer, even if it's one person. Now, will I be the only one? Let's hope not. There are libertarians running all the way across this country. But what's unprecedented in this election is I'm the only alternative to the status quo, the only in this state. There's no Democratic Party running. Typically, if there was, libertarians would be completely dismissed. Mm-hmm. The fact that I'm on this show with you is a huge step, and I congratulate you for that, and I thank you for that.
You bet. Well, thanks for being here.
Yeah. So, for me going to Washington, I can bring that voice. I can walk in both camps, and hopefully I can bring people together.
Let's talk about agriculture. It's kind of a two-part question. Let's first just start with ag. It's our number one industry. Whoever is in Washington, whether at the Senate or House level, they have to make sure they have a seat at the table so South Dakota is being represented when ag is being considered. How will you make sure you're at that table?
I don't have any trouble talking to people, really, given I'm in the right circumstance, and that certainly would be. I would work with our senators and work for whatever we need to do as a state. I'm not sure if you're actually referring to a specific issue agriculturally. The Farm Bill is probably second only to the military in its sheer size and the amount that involves in that.
Let's be specific. Let's go back to this. This spring, many Americans would finally understand the realities behind price fixing in our four major meat packing plants and Absolutely. The investigation underway. What more can be done to help with that issue?
Absolutely. In Fall River County, we even had a get-together of ranchers that would cooperatively build and have their own meat packing facility. And local is always better, whether it's local politics or local sales. My wife is involved in the farmers market. It's important that you buy local. And it's probably healthier, too. So what can be done? What is the roadblock? Or what has made it such the fact that these four manufacturers have got such a monopoly, such a stronghold on the supply? And a lot of it has to do with government regulation, subsidies, in which the government picks winners and losers. And that's got to end. If we're going to really, I am a firm believer in equal treatment under the law, but it's far more than individuals and rights. It's across the board. equality in taxes and equal business standing and what have you. When you subsidize or regulate in such a way that you ingratiate one group or one business over another, they're no longer equal. The competition is gone. And that's not, the free market doesn't exist. We need to reduce those regulations that are creating that problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's move to a couple of the issues South Dakotans will vote on in terms of the ballot. Constitutional Amendment A will, if approved, will allow recreational marijuana, which includes medical within it. Initiated Measure 26 is our medical marijuana bill. If it's approved, it will be legal here in South Dakota. However, many say at the federal level, it's still not approved. Where do you stand on all of those? And should our federal leaders start making some changes?
It's pretty standard libertarian policy, and mine as well, that you own your body. No one should be making decisions for you about your body, be it at some kind of special interest group, certainly not the government, certainly not your neighbor. You get to decide what's best for you. Who is better at that, okay? No matter what it is, what you do with your body, what you put in your body, who you love, all those things belong to you. And there should be no regulation that inhibits that or prohibits that. As long as you're not hurting somebody else, that's your decision and it's nobody else's business. So at the state level, obviously, I'm going to vote for both A and 26.
Okay. So now you make it to Washington.
Yeah.
Does that conversation need to continue there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Stephanie, I'm 62. Almost all those years, this country's been in perpetual war. Undeclared war.
Are you referring to the war on drugs?
The war on drugs is the longest war we've been in, and maybe the most costly.
50 years.
And I call it the war on the American family, because when you, primarily the people that are prosecuted are taken out and maybe even incarcerated are usually males, head of the family. When you remove that, who takes care of those people? The rest of us. It's self-defeating. It creates even more problems. And most of those people are nonviolent. They haven't really hurt anybody, right? They've just made what some of us would consider poor life decisions. That shouldn't be a crime.
Sure.
So the war on drugs has got to be brought to an end. I mean, I'm a big historian. And the war on drugs, I mean, let's look back in time, if we can. In my time, maybe not your time.
Close, but not quite.
when we lost the war in Vietnam, the protesters primarily, not all of them, they were the college students, but the hippie movement and what have you, and they took drugs. When Nixon, he lost the war, or we had to come out because of all the protests and what have you, he, in a knee-jerk reaction, says, we got to have war, we can win. Who was he going to hurt? What was he going to do? Because before that, wars, drugs were not illegal, okay?
Right.
His war started, and the Substance Act turned normal people that formerly were protesters into criminals. And we've been waging that war ever since. It was wrong from the beginning. It's wrong then. It's wrong now. And needs to end.
Okay. Let's move to taxes. One of the things that I noticed you talked about was to appropriately tax people for, and you also talked about how taxes can be carried equally among Americans. So we're talking about equality when it comes to our taxes.
We're back to equal treatment under the law.
How do we do that? How do we make that work?
Okay, we certainly don't do a progressive tax. I mean, the direct tax of income tax was against the Constitution in the first place. It was changed under Wilson, and that's dubious at best anyway, but it's here.
Mm-hmm.
What do? The income tax is not even equal. I mean, it's on a sliding scale.
Right.
Okay. Equal treatment under the law requires that everybody be treated equally. Rich, poor, black, white, whatever. And that's not happening. All right. If we're gonna truly be equal, we need to treat it across the board. And I think I've said that already.
So are you thinking a total reform of our tax structure?
Absolutely. It's been on the boards for a long time. It's called the Fair Tax, and it's an indirect tax. It's a value-added sales tax, and you pay at the cash register. It alleviates a tremendous bureau, the IRS, the invasiveness into our lives. I like to say sometimes that most Americans probably do what they can to get better taxes, be that cheating or whatever. And if you're smart enough and rich enough, you can probably find the loopholes to do so. Not everybody has that ability. Okay, I mean, we look at Donald Trump. He found the loopholes, or his people did, in $750 a year. How much do you pay? I mean, this is not equal treatment under the law. And it needs to change. And but what it will do in the long run, because that's along with Social Security, that we make a lot of money these ways, even though it's not enough to pay for the bills that Congress has allocated, along with the balanced budget, it will reduce the size of our government and rein it in.
Okay. We're going to switch and talk about our country's debt. You referenced it earlier in our conversation, but I'm going to encompass it with the money that has been sent to Americans through the CARES Act. COVID-19 impacted families. The government put together some funding to help those. While that money is going out, our debt has increased. It's over $20 trillion right now.
Outrageous.
How do we have a conversation about handling our debt while at the same time helping those Americans that are struggling because of the pandemic?
Well, I mean, fundamentally, you have to go a little bit further in that question, okay? Why are they struggling in the first place? What happened in this pandemic that created this struggle? And you have to visit that first. What was the number you threw out?
It's over $20 trillion.
$20 trillion now with the new allocation or whatever. Of that, not a very big percentage actually went to actual Americans. All right, it went to businesses, it went to corporations, it went to other various things. And that in and of itself should be alarming. I mean, if you're going to give it to the Americans, give them back. How about they don't pay taxes this year? I mean, the money they received is probably, in many cases, far greater than the taxes that they pay. I mean, who is thinking this through? No, I can't think anybody is, all right? I mean, some people think, well, we'll just print more money. We'll just borrow more money. But this has been going on for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So, getting back to your question.
Mm-hmm.
The COVID issue, it's far more important that we visit why these people are struggling, and as opposed to the amount of money they're being paid, and because that probably shouldn't have or couldn't have had to happen if we had dealt with this thing better.
So you think that conversation should happen? I mean, the election will happen in November, whomever goes. Do we start the conversation about paying off our debt now, or do we wait to see what the pandemic does?
Well, we always have to have that conversation about paying off our debt. It should always be on our mind.
Sure.
So that answers that question, but should we wait till after the election? No, we need to talk about it now. I mean, what's Dusty's plan? You know? I'm saying that we actually take a real strong look at what we're spending and what we're getting in, and a constitutional amendment to balance the budget that forces Congress to keep those purse strings tight.
Sure. Okay. We're talking about a lot of issues. I'm going to switch subjects now. Let's talk about our infrastructure. We have aging infrastructure really all across the United States.
You're talking about roads and bridges?
Roads, bridges, even right here in South Dakota. During certain times of the year, some of our poor farmers and ranchers can't even use the roads because they are so old and they are deteriorating. What would you do or could you do if you made it to Washington to shine a spotlight on our aging infrastructure and start to provide some resources and help for those communities?
Right. Interstate commerce is the federal government's job. That's the roads that connect us between all our states. Within the state, it's primarily the job of the state to maintain the roads and bridges. It is aging and it has to be maintained at all times. What's interesting about that is some of the taxes that we pay, the gas and what have you taxes, that are supposed to be ear tagged for transportation. They go to Washington. They don't stay here. They go to Washington. And then they delve them back out to us based on whether we meet criteria or we bend the knee or we do whatever they want. All right? Now, having said that, you take a state like South Dakota, which is sparsely populated. We have a lot of roads and we have a lot of bridges, as opposed to, say, I'm going to throw out Connecticut or whatever. Heavily populated, all right, but it's much smaller. Mm-hmm. Fewer roads, fewer bridges. It's almost like we have to have extra help from the federal government because we don't have enough tax revenue to build our own roads and make our own bridges. I mean, it starts at the county level. I live in Fall River County. We've got several bridges right now that need to be repaired.
Yeah.
And they're several years out. And the county can't do it. They have to look to the state. And the county is just an arm of the state, really. But I'm trying to answer your question. I'm probably rambling.
But you think it's an important conversation that needs to happen at the federal level.
Absolutely. And we need the money that we generated here, probably plus some. But we don't need it with strings attached.
Let's switch to broadband. I know at the state level we have leaders that are trying to expand broadband, trying to help, you know, make that internet connection better. What we would discover this last spring, in parts of our state, the internet connection is terrible. Kids that had to learn remotely struggled doing it. And teachers right now are crying for help because they fear if we have to send kids back home and they have to learn remotely, that internet connection it's not gonna help them. If you make it to Washington, do you think there could be things that our legislative leaders, our federal leaders could do to expedite that problem?
It's basically supply and demand. If the demand is low, well, it's most likely you're not going to find a private entity is going to move in there and supply that when there's nothing involved for them in profit. And that's the bottom line. Having the government take over and run the whole, I don't think that's the answer either. We have already in this country, I might be digressing here, but the news media, I may be even involving public broadcast in that, is so controlled, if you will, from many aspects by the government and by certain corporate entities that they can manipulate public opinion. And they can create great change for whatever they want simply because they're the only ones that can do it. We have to guard against that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so how does that apply to broadband?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the answer is if you're in an area that's remote and you don't have broadband, maybe you can corporately connect with your neighbors or various other areas and say, look, you know, let's work together and get our own. That would be far better to me than having the government take over.
Okay.
And certainly far better than having a few select corporations in control.
Okay. So maybe reaching within our own state to find some solutions.
Absolutely. I mean, the 10th Amendment, everything that's not detailed in the Constitution, as far as the responsibilities of the federal government, belong to the states or to the people. In that case, that would be the people.
Okay. There's different conversations as to which direction we need to go in terms of any type of gun law. What do you think that conversation needs to look like?
Well, first of all, rights, Stephanie, are things you don't need permission for, okay? Let's be real clear about that. We have the right to own and bear arms. We don't need permission. Anytime you start legislating, that means you're saying you have to have permission to do this. And we don't need permission. It's a right, okay? We have right to freedom of speech. We don't need somebody's permission to tell us when we can and can't speak. All right? So let's keep our rights. That's paramount. And the most important right is individual rights.
So that's where we're at with that.
There's no question. You have the right to own and bear arms, and you don't need permission. And anytime you require licensing and certification and all that, that's like, well, you need our permission to do that. No, I don't need your permission.
Mm-hmm. We're going to wrap up here. I've asked you about a lot of different things, everything from ACT to taxes to environment.
We just stuck the surface. What about the rest of the visionary things?
You have a lot of them on there,
yes,
but I only have an hour show. But I want to give you, you know, the opportunity. What was one thing that you hoped to talk to today that you hope voters understand about you and what you would do if you make it to Washington? One thing that I didn't ask you.
Being a child of the 60s and the 70s, we need to end the wars. The undeclared wars. Our military should be used for defense only. We need to bring our men home. We have wasted our youth. We've wasted our resources. I mean, the Middle East war, what do we spend over there? $17 trillion? I mean, not that I would say that we should use it to pay for everybody's health care or pay off their student loan, but I mean, my God. And what did we get for that?
Mm-hmm.
We got dead bodies, and we killed a lot of innocent civilians. It's got to end, people, all right? And it's up to Congress to say, they need to take back that right. It used to be, before we could use our troops anywhere, there had to be a declaration of war that was approved by the people through their representatives. That hasn't happened since the 60s. We need it back. The executive branch is to execute the will of the people as put forth by the representatives, not make policy and not pursue policy. Just execute it.
Mm-hmm.
We tell them what to do through our representatives. I want it back. You should want it back, too.
Your final thoughts today, as voters are listening to our conversation, what would you say to them as they head to the voting booth to vote? And as you've traveled across the state, your final thoughts to voters?
I'm gonna give you two quotes from a Democrat and a Republican. All right. One of my favorite ones is John F. Kennedy. Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And then there's Abraham Lincoln. We must think anew and act anew, then we can save our country. Two very fine men. When you go to the polls, think about what I said about a dysfunctional duopoly. This is not a two-party system, although people will say, oh, this is a two-party system. Look at the candidate. Research the issues, decide what you want, and then vote therefore.
All right. Randy Lou Allen, the Libertarian candidate running for the office of United States House of Representatives. Thanks for coming into Vermilion to visit with me.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Be sure to follow SDPB News on Twitter and Facebook, and check out sdpb.org to read up on all of our news and politics coverage. From the entire SDPB journalism team, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.